Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here around our kitchen table once a week at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Danilana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
And thanks for their support. Thanks to you, our listener. And thanks to all you folks who rallied around the flag here and helped us help support us during our fundraiser. And that is an ongoing thing here. This community radio station gets by with your donations. Go to khoifm.org, find the magic donate button, and do support this fine community radio station. Today we're going to be considering thankfulness and bounty, the things the earth gives us. It's a time for that. It's time for that. And in our studio today.
Yes, and we're giving no turkey recipes today. Right? We're just we are on the gratitude theme.
Yeah. No turkey recipes at all. I hope you have that all taken care of anyway. Okay. So today we have a special guest, Megan Filbert. And we'll get back to her later. And she's here from PFI, and she's going to be talking about...
That is Practical Farmers of Iowa.
Well, she's going to be talking about grass grazing and cows and sheep and all sorts of things. And first, I wish to... I kind of got inspired. I pulled a book off of my bookshelf that I haven't read in a while.
Oh, and a good one it is.
It sort of is the theme of this day's show. It's called All Flesh is Grass, The Pleasures and Promises of Pasture Farming by the author Gene Logsdon. Gene Logsdon is a wonderful farmer.
He's also a very good writer. He's fun to read.
He's very well known for, I think, his book, and I think it was a column for a long time called The Contrary Farmer. He's from Ohio. And this book, All Flesh is Grass, is about how we can get back to and learn a lot from watching and helping and doing our agriculture based on animals. We eat animals a lot, but unfortunately now much of our time and effort and fossil fuels are spent growing row crops and then harvesting them and driving them and processing them, and then we feed them to the cows. And
we put all the animals in a little tiny space where they're not happy, and they do some damage rather than contributing to the ecosystem.
So here, just to get us started here, this is a little paragraph here from Gene Logsdon from his book, All Flesh is Grass, and he proposes that maybe there's a different way to do this. It may sound like agricultural heresy, but there are established, proven ways to produce most of the food that the world needs without tearing up millions of acres of soil every year. We do not have to plant so much land to annual grains to eat. Well, in fact, the continued reliance on annual grains as a major source of feed for farm animals is proving to be the way not to eat well. We can have all the meat, milk, eggs, animal fabrics needed to feed the world without cultivating all those nice seed beds that for centuries have been considering the beginning of agricultural progress. With modern grazing methods, farm animals can get their food mostly from grazing, avoiding the current crippling expense of annual cultivation and grain harvest. Welcome to our table, Megan.
Thank you very much for having me.
Megan Filbert, tell us what you do.
I happily will. I am the Livestock Program Manager at Practical Farmers of Iowa and oversee all of our livestock programming, much of which is centered around livestock production on grass and pastures. So really, I work with a lot of farmers in Iowa who have transitioned corn and soybean acres into perennial forages, or they're grazing on what's considered marginal hilly lands that's not suitable for growing row crops and grains. And they are turning grass into flesh, just like Gene talks about in his book. And they are producing extremely healthy animal protein.
And delicious.
On Iowa pastures. So, I really would love to talk a bit about all this buzz about regenerative agriculture, specifically regenerative grazing. You know, we've been talking about the term sustainable agriculture for years now, but now people are proposing that we get beyond the word sustainable, because we can't just sustain our resources. We need to regenerate them. We need to rebuild them. And so there's a lot of buzz out there about what ruminant animals are animals who have a specialized stomach to be able to digest all of the grass and the forage and the pasture out there. So really there's all this talk about how cows and other ruminants, sheep and goats and deer and everything else that can put on weight from grass, how they can regenerate our soils and sequester carbon into our soils and actually build our organic matters and build our soils back up.
That sounds pretty exciting, a positive thing to do. But it seems like we're working against a idea of what farming is. We think agriculture, that means getting out there with the plow. That means straight lines. That means like commodities and making things with big tractors. This is kind of a big stretch here, a new thing.
Well, and it's, I mean, okay, I'm an old lady, but I can remember farms used to have cows roaming around in fields and little pig huts out in the fields. And so, yeah, so maybe what's old is new.
That's exactly right. So we want to get back to what Iowa used to look like, smaller farms with diversity. Diversity is the name of the game here.
Right, but this is like not stopping progress, because we do have much more research and more information and more science behind it than we used to. So this is not just going backwards.
That's exactly right. So we want to apply principles from the past with modern technology, modern fence technology, electrical fencing. We don't, when we think of fencing, sometimes we think about that tedious three strands of barbed wire with a post every 10 feet. It's actually.
Yeah, that we've mostly torn out and gotten rid of,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. And right. That we have memories from our childhood of having to mend and build. It's a lot simpler now. We can use better, more modern technology.
So that would be
to make the same things happen.
Portable electric fencing?
Portable electric fencing that has step-in posts that you can carry and walk out into the field and put it into the field and take it out and reshape paddocks every which way. There's even a new technology that I'm very interested in called virtual fence.
Oh, come
which,
now.
Which is actually controlling fence from your phone, from your iPhone or your tablet, where you can set fence boundaries. And it's different than dog fencing, because dog fence is actually buried under the ground. There's no burying of this fence. Animals are wearing either an ear tag or a collar, and there's a satellite signal that it's pinging off of. And as soon you build the boundary from your phone, and when those cattle or sheep are getting close to the boundary that you've set, the virtual boundary, it will give them an audible beep. And when they're on the boundary, it actually sends them a small shock. And this fence technology is used in Australia and in Scandinavia, places where there's potentially less predator pressure.
I bet, but we could use this on children, too.
Potentially. So I think that there are incredible implications if we were to adopt and really perfect virtual fence technology for being able to graze all of the acres of Iowa and get back to reintegrating livestock onto our landscape, which is how our landscape evolved.
Now, we're talking we eat lots of different things, and we're not talking about grazing border to border. I mean, we still need places for pumpkins and sweet corn and strawberries. And we haven't figured out any electric fencing for that stuff yet. We still have to get out and till that sort of thing. But the idea...
We could use no-till.
Letting the animals do the work. They can walk out to the field. They can deposit their ever so good manure.
Yes, the little fertilizer machines
They can help themselves. They pretty much know what they want to eat, and also they would be eating a diverse sort of thing. This is a pretty big implication for saving a lot of fossil fuels that right now are growing all this corn for feed and oats for feed and all this stuff for feed.
I often hear speakers talk about, do you want to work for the cows, or are you going to let the cows work for you? And when you graze animals, those cows are your harvester, and they're your manure spreader, and they are doing the work for you. And that's what we want to get to. That's where we can really see decreases in inputs, especially in fossil fuel inputs that we may not always be able to depend on.
I was reading in this book by Gene Loggs, and he talks about a 30-acre farm and doing it on a very small scale and small paddocks and things. But he's talking about not baling hay if you don't need to, not planting corn for silage, but finally, and you can't do this overnight, of course, but getting to where it's true, the cows work for you. And not just
And they're
cows.
Much happier doing that work
I would
than
think
being
so.
put in the confinement lot, right?
So
standing in mud up to their knees.
If we do want the ruminant animals to do the work for us, the question always comes up, what about winter? What do they eat in the winter? And this is where in Iowa. Mm-hmm. This is where we have to get very creative about our forages year-round. And we can call that our forage chain. So we just invited a speaker from Argentina. His name's Annabel Portamingo, and he is a animal scientist who has studied grass feeding and grass finishing of cattle and forage chains throughout the world and how we can get animals to consume forages on a year-round basis, even places where we deal with winter. And what needs to happen is – a big part of this is stockpiling your pastures, so reserving some of your perennial pastures for the winter. So you wouldn't graze them as heavily as you would during the summer grazing season, and you would reserve those pastures to eat in the winter. And it turns out that the cold and the snow actually acts as an insulative layer and preserves the quality of that grass. So it's still high quality feed under that snow. And cattle and sheep can graze right through the snow, and they'll actually even eat the snow as their water source.
Huh. Pretty smart, aren't they?
Another way to extend your grazing season is to graze cover crops. So cover crops are a crop that is planted after your soybean or corn harvest. And they're winter hardy, and they grow into cold weather. So they're out there green right now, growing, and will be the first thing to come back up in the spring. So that's another way to extend that grazing season into the winter.
So grazing through the snow, how deep does the snow have to get before the cows can't manage it?
I haven't heard that it's necessarily a problem of depth, because they will burrow up to their eyes. When it's past their eyes, I think that's probably
deep, yeah.
I'd give up then, too. Yeah.
But really, it's a matter of ice. If we do get an ice storm and there's an ice layer on top of the snow or on top of the fields, that's where you really need to have a backup, some supplement to mm-hmm. back them up. Mm-hmm. So some hay in the barn.
Mm-hmm. But not enough for a whole winter. Cows can, well, actually, and sheep and others, they can take care of themselves. Yes, they can. We hear a lot about... Now, a grass-fed seems to be the buzzword, a grass-fed. And
well, because it's healthier for the humans that eat the grass-fed, because when the cows are eating grass, which is what they're, you know, they were originally created to eat, they make the fat in the cow as we call it, the fatty acid profile, has a different composition than if they're corn and grain fed. But the composition, which includes more gamma-linolenic acid, among other things, is actually much healthier for human beings and does not contribute to, like, heart disease, for example, in humans. So people are now really wanting to eat grass-fed beef and other animals because it's healthier for the human that's eating it. And also it's doesn't, you know, usually the grass that they're eating has not been sprayed with herbicides and pesticides, and all of that has not gone into the animal as well. So it is a healthy choice. It is a trendy choice. And I'm telling you, restaurant chefs cannot get their hands on enough of this grass-fed beef.
Sounds good.
Yep.
Megan, you mentioned this man from Argentina. He had all sorts of studies about the difference between grass-fed and well, what would you call it? Conventional feedlot fed?
Grain fed.
Okay. And he had some, well, people like hard, fast numbers. It's not just, I told you so, but he talked about official numbers. Are these the omega numbers?
Yes, they sure are. So Annabelle Portamingo showed us 20 years of research on the omega-3 versus omega-6 fatty acid profile in the foods, and it's particularly the meats we eat. So he presented research on grass-fed beef compared to grain-fed beef. And I have been working with two farmers in Iowa doing some on-farm research on that very thing. And what we've done is recently sent in 30 grass-fed and finished, so 100% grass-fed beef ribeyes, to the Iowa State University's meat lab for a fatty acid profile analysis.
Yeah.
And what we're finding, which correlates with the findings that Annabelle Portamingo presented based on 20 years of research, is that really we want to see a fatty acid omega-3 to omega-6 profile of a ratio of one omega-3 to four omega-6. That is what is recommended by the America Heart Association.
1 to 6, okay.
There are studies out there that show that when you get a 1 to 2 ratio, closer to that 1 to 1 ratio, that's where these cancer-fighting properties are present and where we can actually help prevent against cardiovascular disease.
Ah, regenerative.
Supposedly, hunters and gatherers ate a diet that consisted of a 1 to 1 ratio. So that's the pinnacle here.
Yeah, that's the optimum.
The average American diet now is 1 to 20. So it's a very skewed ratio.
Ooh.
And what skews it so heavy on the omega-6 side is vegetable oils, corn oil, soybean oil, lots of
cotton
things
seed oil
that we fry, that yeah, fried food is cooked in.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
So what we're finding is that these grass-fed ribeyes are a 1 to 1.8 ratio. So I'll round up, 1 to 2 ratio, which is what has been proven to actually fight cancer and heart disease. So that is very encouraging.
These are healthy cows. This is good.
And I want to mention here, this is also true for grass-fed butter, grass-fed milk, all of the products that come from cows besides meat. If you're buying grass-fed, like the Kelowna Dairy, they are the first dairy in the country to actually go for the American Grass-Fed Association certification on their products. So we can buy.
That is exactly right.
We can buy it here. Also, Organic Valley has some grass-fed butters, yogurts, milks. We can do this.
We are doing this. And not to forget grass-fed eggs.
Yes.
You know, I know chickens do eat some grain, but when chickens are able to forage and pick through grasses and insects, that omega 3 to 6 ratio will be more in our favor.
Yeah, and it gives you lovely, deep yellow yolks, right, Lana?
Right. I have a question. When you talk about feedlots, you hear a term finishing. What is a finishing?
So beef production is split up into three phases. The first is cow-calf, which is mothers giving birth to cows and it's raising calves until they are weaned, until they are finished drinking mother's milk. The next phase of production, or life, is backgrounding, or stockers, which that's kind of just cattle lingo for raising, fattening adolescent teenager cows.
Uh-huh. And it's usually out in the field.
Most of the time, that is still on pastures. Mm-hmm. That's still on grasses, because they have to transition from being born on grass and eating grass to transition to grain. You can't just change that overnight. So that backgrounding stage is where they're still predominantly on grass, but are being introduced to grain and getting their rumen used to grain. And then the finisher phase is when animals are sent to a feedlot to be finished.
On grain.
Mostly on grain.
And the odd thing is, we don't realize that most of these three phases actually happen on completely different farms.
That's exactly right. So there's a lot of shipping of live animals between these three phases in conventional production. I will also say that there are producers, there are farmers that are giving birth to the calves and finishing them all on the same farm. So there's all different ways to frame this production, mm-hmm. but the conventional system is to have three different farms for three different phases of life.
Ha! And we're finding that there is a different – to not put so much grain in at the end, because guess what? I guess cows weren't really meant to eat a lot of corn. I suppose you could if they found a corn stalk, they'd eat it. But if that's all they had to eat, I don't think they're very happy.
It's that corn at the end is putting on fat and is putting on weight
and not
to that animal.
Not the good fats.
But those fats, again, are getting away from that 1-to-1 or 1-to-4 ratio that we want to see. The numbers I've seen around grain finished animals are closer to a 1-to-10. They're not a 1-to-20, but they're a 1-to-10. Whereas a lot of conventional pork chops that I've seen tested, pork again is predominantly fed grain and doesn't have much forage in their diet. There could be closer to a 1-to-24 or a 1-to-30 ratio.
Ooh, bad.
Ouch.
Yes.
So, yeah.
So the quality of fat matters.
The quality of fat matters.
And the quality of the fat of the animal is based on what it has been fed.
That's exactly right. We are what we eat.
So we're thinking about a new way of doing things, because all of this, not just affects the end product, but to get there, all of this row cropping and moving that stuff around and shipping it here and there in big piles of corn. Here's a little sentence or two from Gene Logston about the difference between till farming, conventional farming, and pasture farming. Till farming is control farming. Control farming is expensive and economically and ecologically dreadfully expensive. Pasture farming, on the other hand, requires a humble dependence on forces beyond our control. Pasture farming recognizes that our survival depends upon our ability to stand by patiently, work in partnership with nature, and not in domination over nature. You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is a tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to Megan Filbert about grass and getting food from grass. We can't eat a lot of grass, you know, and do a lot with it, but there are animals that we depend on that do that sort of thing. Megan, let's talk a little bit about animal welfare, for one thing, and the fact that animals maybe do a little bit better on grass.
So it was mentioned earlier that grass-fed and grass-fed beef is all the rage. And because of that, we have seen an uptick in consumers purchasing grass-fed beef. But really the fear in the grass-fed industry is that because of this growing demand and to continue to
and
keep
price premium
and to keep costs low, and that like we talked about earlier, this finishing stage of an animal's life, animals are still going to be put into feedlots, and instead of being fed corn, they're going to be fed grass, but in a feedlot system. So that gets around this. It gets us to a more healthier end product.
Right. But the beef is better if it's fed grass, no matter where it's fed the grass.
That's right.
However, there are other consequences.
However, that's still not getting us any much better of an animal welfare system.
Nor is it dealing with the problem of all the manure and CAFOs.
That's exactly right. Those are the persistent issues.
Yes, and it's not using the cows to improve the soil in the pasture.
That's exactly right.
Right.
So we know we want animals out actively grazing on pastures to do the best we can for those forages and for that soil. When you put them in a feedlot and they're then again on a concrete or kind of muddy floor, that's still not regenerating or building our soils like we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. And it's still concentrating manure in one place that is going to potentially pose an environmental issue down the line.
Yeah. And while I would encourage anybody to eat any grass-fed beef that they can afford, and definitely the feedlot-fed grass is healthier for you. I mean, the feedlot grass-fed beef is healthier for you than the conventional corn-fed beef. And the imports coming in from Australia, where they're doing a lot of that, are less expensive, but it's not the be-all and the end-all. So, you know, everybody has to make their own kind of ethical choices, their health choices, and, of course, their pocketbook choices. But we're really aiming for the best of all possible worlds.
That's
is
right.
To eat. And there are standards and labels, too. Like the American Grass-Fed Association has a standard that is often put on labels.
Or animal welfare.
Animal welfare
is a label.
Standards are another label. And speaking of animal welfare standards, we haven't even mentioned pastured pork, which is like Nyman Ranch pork. It's all what's their standard? They have humane animal welfare standards.
It's a animal welfare approved, I
right.
believe.
Right. I think that's right. And
yep.
Getting the pigs out of the confinements is equally important because they're very helpful out on the pasture as well. Now, they're still fed some grains, but they do forage. They do put their manure in appropriate places. They are moved around with the same kinds of electric fencing that Megan was talking about.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Pigs will still forage. They will eat some grass.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're getting enough grass, they will eat less grain. But they're also just able to stay healthier when they have fresh grass and fresh air and sunshine.
And space.
And space to run
around.
And
they're not sitting in their CAFO inhaling the gases from their decaying excreta.
Right. I did just learn that most all pigs raised in confinement do have lung damage at slaughter.
Yep.
And if anyone has walked in there or even driven by, you know what that smells like. Imagine what that smells like to that pig who has to inhale that the entirety of their life.
And the farmer who has to go in and manage those pigs.
Right.
It's a health hazard for the farmers and the pigs.
That's right.
So lots of things can eat grass. And, well, it's as if They were all made, like, to live on this earth. Surprise, surprise.
Wow, what a design plan. Yeah. Genius, I would say.
As far as grazing is concerned, there's also this multi-species use of pasture. Not just one kind of creature needs to be on a pasture. Let's talk about sheep a little bit. You ran across a really good sheep book, Megan. So can you talk about that book?
I sure did. I am currently reading a book called The Art and Science of Grazing, which is by a French grazer, pastoralist, and a man named Fred Provenza, who is an animal behaviorist who lives out west in the United States. And they wrote a book on the history of nomadic herders, shepherds in the hills, the Alps and the Pyrenees in France, just nomadically living with their sheep. And the incredible thing about this is that those shepherds know exactly what those sheep should be eating and when they should be eating it.
And where to find it.
And where to find mm-hmm. it. So by the subtle movements they make with their body, or by just very subtle sounds that they might make to their herd, they are signaling that herd to eat higher quality species of forages or lower quality, because both of those species balance out each other. So when you have an animal eat a high quality forage, they're going to automatically, their neurons in their brain and in their stomach will tell them they need to balance that out with something lower quality. So it's a fine balancing act.
What's the name of the book?
The Art and Science of Shepherding. The Art and Science of Shepherding.
I got it.
And really, it is not just a science. There is an art to it. It's that fine balance. And this book is relaying really the history and the institutional knowledge of the centuries of these herders in France. And there really isn't that many texts out there that have documented this knowledge. It's really just passed down from generation to generation. And mm-hmm. we're at this time in our history where there's not that many young people that want to take it over.
Well, and we're in danger of losing that knowledge.
That's exactly right.
I have to go back to I went with Paul Willis, who's the Nyman Ranch, really the founder of the mm-hmm. of the pork systems, and we were at PFI last week, and he was saying exactly with pigs, they do this farrowing is done sometimes separately. So very few people at this point are raising the pigs from birth all the way through. And he said, well, you know, your grandfather might have done that, but by this, if your father didn't do it, we are losing the ability to know how to actually implant grow the babies,
That's right.
Get the starter pigs.
So I've heard that we are now at least two generations removed from the knowledge of animal birth or piglet farrowing, but also livestock raising, just handling and raising and mm-hmm. working around livestock. Because when Iowa suffered a divorce between livestock and
cropping
systems,
yeah.
we lost the know-how of how to raise animals.
So in cattle, it's called cow-calf, right?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Well, and it's not these are living things. You can learn a lot. You have the experience of raising sheep yourself, and sheep know things. They're not just dumb as sheep. They are pretty smart as far as what to eat. They talk.
That's exactly right. So sometimes when I go out to the pasture to move them to their next paddock.
Wait. We have to insert in the story that Megan is raising how many sheep?
Eight Katahdin sheep
on Joe and Lana's farm.
That's exactly
right. So they're like
I'm learning a lot.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Megan.
We are an alliance, a sheep-raising alliance. So what I do sometimes, since it's usually only me out there in the pasture building fence, I need to build the fence for them for the next few days. And what I do is I'll let the sheep out and they'll just kind of have free roam and they'll go choose what they want to eat. And I build fence around that because I know that that's what they want. So as long as it's in the general vicinity that I'm trying to move them towards and in an area that they haven't grazed yet or where that has been rested enough, I will just let them choose what they want and I'll put a fence up around them. So I watch them and learn from them. They're telling me what they want.
Also, they respond to you. I used to totally, as they say, freak out if they got out of the fence. They know where home is. And they'll, if they see Megan, they'll generally come running. They're nice little beasties. They've got, they have got survival skills kind of foremost in their brains.
That's exactly right.
So now, you didn't know that Lana and Megan are both shepherdesses also.
Well, yes, we are.
Yeah, I'm kind of in your learning curve here.
But
watching animals feed themselves. We don't have to like take stuff out to them. They feed themselves. Megan kind of makes sure they has a new little place to eat. And yes, in the winter we will have some supplemental hay. But they know what they're doing. They really do. They're smart little beasties. I like that a lot. This is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Support this radio station. Go to KHOIFM.org and find out more about this radio station and also support us. Support us. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are around the kitchen table today with Megan Filbert. And we're kind of sliding into the Thanksgiving season here. We're going to talk about some things to be thankful for. And I want to mention just a few, somebody to be thankful for. Chestnuts. We've talked about chestnuts before. And I want to say I'm thankful for a guy named Philip Rutter in southeastern Minnesota. 40 years ago, he decided he was going to do something about the lack of chestnuts.
Right. We had the chestnut blight. We lost our American chestnuts.
So Philip Rutter and his son Brandon have been slowly and patiently reviving the American chestnut, breeding new chestnuts.
With the Chinese chestnut. Uh-huh. That was immune to whatever the blight was.
And so he founded the Badger Set Research Corporation. And the good news is that things are thriving. We are getting domestic chestnuts again. So that's one thing to be thankful for. Here's another Thanksgiving-y kind of thing. A woman named Dorcas Riley. Dorcas Riley, and she has passed away. It was in the news a bit ago. This person should be, we should raise a glass to her at all Thanksgiving gatherings because she was the inventor of the green bean casserole. And I don't know what can be more American than that.
So I don't know. Maybe not everyone is celebrating that invention.
I like it. Yeah. Now, in 1955, she responded to a Campbell's Soup Company contest to come up with something to use Campbell's soup in. And she did. Campbell's cream of mushroom soup. And it had six ingredients. Then, and it probably just has six ingredients now, cream of mushroom soup, milk, soy sauce, black pepper, and French fried onions, that stuff in the
can.
It has to come in the can. So, three cheers for Dorcas Riley. And believe it or not, approximately 40% of all cream of mushroom soup goes to that recipe. So thanks.
Whoa, I believe it. What a marketing coup.
What a marketing coup. That's good. And also, let's make a little thought to cranberries. Cranberries grow in foggy, kind of wet areas. And they're produced commercially and actually kind of in the same way that rice is flooded for pest control and harvesting and things like that. Cranberries are, too. There's some big, big producers. Actually, here in the Midwest, big producers up in central Wisconsin. But there are some. They think they have to use a lot of pesticides because it is a monocrop. And so that's been heavily pesticided. And so be careful about those. And also, the pesticides are not doing so good for the bees. Cranberries need bees. So there are some organic cranberries.
I will say, I stopped into Hy-Vee just this last weekend, and I asked for organic cranberries, and they pointed me in the direction. And they had these organic, biodynamic cranberries from Wisconsin. And I read the label, and they're spring-fed, so non-irrigated, and organic, and even biodynamic at that. So I happily purchased that bag of cranberries.
There you go. They are there. Why should we eat this stuff that is not good for us, especially on the day when we're going to be thankful for things? Oh, I like cranberries. I do. And, yes, finding out about that, cranberries, I read about cranberries in a book called In Winter's Kitchen by Beth Dooley. Had a little thing about cranberries. Cranberries have a little air pocket in each little fruit, believe it or not, which is why they can commercially shake them off of the low-growing bushes into a bog, and the cranberries float.
They float, and then they kind of corral them in and harvest them.
So, isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing?
Those clever cranberries.
Now, they're always going to be in some sort of boggy area, but they weren't always flooded commercially and harvested with big machines. Native Americans or early settlers harvested them with rake baskets, kind of a device that was a basket and a rake all at once. Hard work, but go through and you can rake them off, too. And that's maybe, I don't know, people are trying to do that again. You don't get as many as, of course, with the fancy machine harvesting. But
once again, higher quality.
They're saying
if you find something,
they're trying to get into something called dry harvesting. And that means that they're not sitting around in water, and supposedly they last a lot longer. So three cheers for cranberry, something I'm thankful for. Yes, I am. What about you guys? What you thankful for? Anything more about cows, about sheep?
Well, I got a very pleasant pheasant present, and I'm thankful for that. Now, I just had to say that. Pleasant pheasant present.
It was. You got a pheasant.
Yeah. Paul Willis brought me back. It's pheasant season, and he brought me a pheasant that he had hunted. And, of course, it came all cleaned up and frozen and just ready to cook. And I'm very grateful for the pheasant season.
Very good.
And I am thankful for having a strong community of people around me that help hand slaughter some animals. So this last weekend, we slaughtered two of the sheep in the herd that we had previously mentioned.
And that is a lot of work, isn't it?
We did everything by hand, and luckily we are close with avid hunter who knows exactly what to do. And these sheep went through the most animal welfare approved situation they could.
Yes.
Humane slaughter they could.
Yeah, Paul always says, my pigs only have one bad day in their life.
That's exactly right. These sheep had their one bad day on Sunday. And then with a group of friends, we processed all of that meat, and I now have a freezer full. So I am thankful for that going into the winter because I can rely on that healthy nourishment in my freezer.
Yum!
Very.
You learn to be thankful for your protein if you ever volunteer to help with, chickens or ducks or harvesting deer, too. If you ever help with that, you realize, for one thing, you realize that whether it's a chicken or deer or sheep, you know, the insides of all of us look pretty much the same. We really are all in this together.
And the nice thing about harvest, it when you're harvesting animals or even any, it used to always be a communal event. It wasn't just some lone farmer driving around on his tractor. It takes a community to harvest.
I could have never done that alone. And with with five people, it still took hours and hours.
Yeah, two sheep is, it's a big deal.
It is.
How much do you think they weighed each?
I think they each weighed between 115 and 130 pounds.
And this is a testament. Both, one of the sheep was 8 months old?
7 months old.
7 months old. It grew that, and this was a big guy. It was a big, it grew on grass.
On
right,
only
it was born
grass.
There, and it ended its life there.
That's right.
And it'll be eaten.
So we
right
produced,
on Onion Creek Farm.
We produced about 60 pounds of meat, edible protein.
In 7 months, on
in
grass.
7 months, from sunshine, essentially.
Ooh. Yeah. And they do eat all sorts of different things, which is nice. Actually, we had a good time running them into old garden beds. They cleaned up things very nicely.
They loved the okra. I couldn't believe how much they loved the okra.
And it was a bumper okra year, right,
yeah,
Lana?
Yeah. And I was way too sick of picking some of that
stuff.
Okay,
so now we have okra-fed lamb.
That's exactly right.
Talk about fancy. Oh, very good. Well, think about where your meat comes from and think about the impact of on the earth. We can learn new things, and it will be a transition from thinking of farming. Does farming always mean putting yourself on a tractor and planting huge amounts of straight lines? Maybe not. There are other ways to grow animals. And if you're a little bit humble and decide to learn a little bit from the animals, yeah, it's pretty good. I'm learning about this sheep thing. That's good. That's good.
It's fun, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It is.
Even when the little darlings get out of their pen, they did get out, and they went and stood on the neighbor's porch one day, and we got a telephone call. That was midsummer. They do get frisky, but they know where home is, and it's been a pleasure. Megan, can you kind of tell us where you can learn about this sort of thing? There's field days. Give us contact information.
Absolutely. For the upcoming winter seasons, Practical Farmers of Iowa hosts a Farminar series. So Farminars are what we call webinars because they're farmer-led. And our Farminars are each Tuesday night from November till March. And you can find all of those listings on our website, practicalfarmers.org. But also, we have our biggest event of the year is our Practical Farmers of Iowa annual conference.
And hooray, hooray, my favorite event.
So that event is hosted at the Scheman Center on Iowa State's campus in Ames, Iowa. And it's January 17th through the 19th, 2019. And we get about 1,000 farmers. And it is the best opportunity to network with other like-minded farmers and learn new things. And kind of the star event, the pinnacle event at that conference is our potluck, which Donna
the
is in charge of.
The Friday night potluck.
That's
where
right.
We're going to have John Gilbert's pig, cooked, processed and cooked at the Story City Locker. We will have Earl Hafner's early morning harvest polenta and buns made out of his wheat. We'll have salad from Lee's Greens, and then the rest will be potluck and whatever people.
Hundreds of potluck dishes.
Yes, it's fun. It's really good fun.
And really showcases the best, most delicious Iowa foods.
Yeah. Oh, and we'll have local beer.
We will have local beer from Alluvial Brewery.
That's right. And See? Probably some people end up bringing the local Iowa whiskey, too.
They sure do.
Cedar Ridge Reserve.
It is a
pot. Oh, yeah, yeah. We eat well here in Iowa.
Yeah,
yes,
and
we
a
do.
Gathering, that's something to be thankful for. And one thing about this organization, you learn all kinds of things you never thought you'd learn. There are people that are not farmers at all. There are just people
that like
to eat, and they're very concerned about farming. They're concerned, and they want to help, and they want to learn. So, not all members of PFI are farmers. There's people that are involved in the food industry, of course, but there's people that just are, we are all involved in the food industry.
Well, because we live in a farming community.
Because we eat.
What goes on around us affects our water, affects our air. It certainly changes the nature of the landscape. I mean, I can't imagine living in Iowa and not knowing about agriculture.
And I should mention that all of our events and conference sessions at our upcoming conference there will be sessions geared towards Friend of Farmers. And all of our field days in the summer, they're open to the public, and we encourage non-farmers to get out and learn about farming.
How many field days did you guys do?
About 32 this last summer and fall.
It's quite amazing. Quite amazing and very interesting.
What a good resource. So that's upcoming, but the webinars are upcoming soon. Give contact website again.
Practicalfarmers.org.
We can do that. We can do that. Also, I'd like to mention there's some this coming Saturday, November 24th, the Central Polar Barn Dance is having a barn dance, and that is at 130 South Sheldon Avenue, 7:37 o'clock in the evening. For information, call 515-292-0117. This is a great dance. It's after Thanksgiving. So you kind of like dance down your Thanksgiving dinner. And you can bring all your leftover house guests. Also, Saturday is a buy local Saturday.
We can and Friday, which will be, it's come to be known as Black Friday, it's also Buy Nothing Day if you want to be contrarian and, you know, rise up against the corporate culture. It's Buy Nothing Day on Friday, and then Saturday is Buy Local Day.
We can do that. It's a small thing, and we can
We're big shoppers, boy oh boy.
Next Tuesday, November 24th, there's a Farm to Folk open house, 4 to 6 at the First Methodist Church. It's a holiday open house. Meet your farmer. First Methodist Church, that's on Kellogg in Ames.
4 o'clock on
Tuesday. 4 o'clock across from the post office. Yes, it is. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. Thanks to Megan Filbert for Practical Farmers of Iowa for joining us today. We've been talking about the fact that all flesh is grass. We've been talking about grass-based agriculture.
And yummy meat.
Yes,
healthy
meat.
Healthy.
Support this fine radio station. You can become a member. The $55 membership will help us, or any kind of number that you want to come up with lots of zeros behind it. We appreciate that, too. You can call 515-292-2878 to donate, or donate online, khoyfm.org. Support this fine radio station. We thank you, our listeners, and thank our supporters. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We've had fine engineering, as always, by Evan Taylor.
And happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to all. Eat good food and enjoy life.